This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
My name's Sophie Cunningham and I'm the chair for this evening, and I would like to welcome you all to the second edition of the Long Form Society. And tonight we're going to be discussing Maggie Nelson's The Argonauts. Before I launch in, I'd like to acknowledge that we're meeting today on the traditional lands of the Kulin Nation, and I pay my respects to their elders, past, present and future. For those who want to keep talking about whatever it is that we end up discussing tonight, there's going to be a forum that you can find on the homepage of the Wheeler Centre, and that'll be going, I think, tonight, but more particularly tomorrow, there'll be conversation taking place there. And if you want to engage with social media about the event, the hashtag Longform Society. Okay, now I'm going to leap into introducing our speakers, but I'll start by introducing Maggie Nelson, who is not here this evening, even though she'll be here in spirit. She's an American writer. She's an award-winning poet, as well as the author of 5 books of non-fiction, including The Art of Cruelty, A Reckoning, from 2011, Her book from 2009, Bluettes, about pain, pleasure and the colour blue, was named as one. Red Parts, Autobiography of a Trial, was published in 2007, and that's the second book she's written about the murder of her aunt, Jane Mixer. She wrote a poetry book about that murder as well. And she wrote, at the beginning of her career, in 2007, Women, the New York School and Other True Abstractions. But we're here tonight to talk about The Argonauts, which was published in 2015. It won the National Book Critics Circle Award. It was a New York Times bestseller. She has since received the MacArthur Fellowship, which I think the slang for that is the Genius Prize, which I think she found a title she found a bit overwhelming. And she's won many other significant awards and grants. There's a lot that could be said about this book. I'm just going to read from one very laudatory review, which was this one for the Los Angeles Times, that talked about the way that Nelson circles away and back again to central questions about deviance and normalcy, family making and love. What Nelson is asking throughout the book is, how does anyone decide what's normal and what's radical? What kinds of experiences do we close ourselves off to when we think we already know? Our speakers this evening, on my far left, we have Quinn Eades. He's a writer, researcher and a poet who works at the place where autobiography, philosophy, poetry and critical theory meet. He's currently working on his third book, Transpositions, which is a fragmented autobiography of the transitioning body, and I believe a couple of his books are on sale at the back of the room if you want to purchase them on the way out. Hannah McCann, in the middle, is a lecturer in gender studies at the University of Melbourne. She teaches courses on feminism, queer theory, sex and power, and her research work to date has focused largely on queer femme subculture within the LGBTIQ community. She is currently working on a book called Queering Femininity, Sexuality, Feminism and the Politics of Presentation. And as closest to me, Onyx works under their legal name as Sarah Jane Norman. Onyx has been hailed as one of the most challenging and rigorous Australian experimental artists of their generation. Over the course of their 13-year solo career, Onyx has created a diverse body of interdisciplinary work spanning durational, intimate and body-based performance, dance, installation, sculpture, text, sound and moving image. Also an accomplished writer and editor, Onyx's poetry, prose and fictocritical work has seen publication in Mianjin, Overland, the Cultural Studies Review of Australia, Stylus, just to name a few. They've been placed in numerous awards, including the Judith Wright Poetry Prize, the DJ Dini O'Hearn Award. Their forthcoming short story collection is currently shortlisted for the inaugural Kill Your Darlings, on Gadigal land of Wiradjuri, Woonera and Anglo-Celtic ancestry. Onyx has been based in Berlin since 2009. They currently divide their time between Berlin and unceded Wurundjeri land.
That was a really dense bio.
I'm sorry.
I just kind of copied and pasted without considering the context.
But it is, I think getting words right is important tonight, and that's one of the things that this book is about, really, is about precision in language and doing these things well. So I gave it my best shot.
That was great.
Because there is so much in this book that I have been inspired by and taken pleasure in, it was one of the reasons why I was very keen that we talk about it as part of the Long Form Society. When I was trying to think about ways into the material, I decided what I really wanted was just for to start with, for the panellists to read out paragraphs that have particularly stood out for them. That I don't mean by that they have to have adored them or thought they were fantastic, just that they have really stayed with them, and maybe tell us a little bit about what it was in that paragraph that spoke to them, and then we'll move to a more general conversation. So I'm going to start by reading one of the passages that leapt out at me. I actually had 20 pages earmarked for possible reading, and I just grabbed one of them in no particular order of importance. Okay, so I'm going to read from the text edition, page 33. Page 31. One of the most annoying things about hearing the refrain same-sex marriage over and over again is that I don't know many, if any, queers who think of their desire's main feature as being same-sex. It's true that a lot of lesbian sex writing from the 70s was about being turned on and even politically transformed by an encounter with sameness. Important, as it has to do with seeing reflected that which has been reviled, with exchanging alienation or internalised revulsion for desire and care. To devote yourself to someone else's pussy can be a means of devoting yourself to your own. But whatever sameness I've noted in my relationships with women is not the sameness of woman, and certainly not the sameness of parts, rather is a shared, crushing understanding of what it means to live in a patriarchy. The reason why that passage leapt out at me was because I was considered heterosexual till I was 37, and then I started going out with a woman, and ever since then I've been fending off questions about would I still be a lesbian if I broke up with my wife. Look, endless questions about my sexuality which I never really had to deal with before, and I found people's extreme interest strange. I didn't not one that was it was meaningful to them. And I've certainly shared that. The last sentence really is what I'm speaking to here, which is the notion of the understanding of what it means to live in a patriarchy and my particular sense of liberation about being in a queer relationship was not having to perform a particular femininity. That, to me, was the most extraordinary release. I mention that because this book is very... If you've read it, that hasn't had... It kind of... it's quite... It's a bit like a prism, I think. It throws up all kind of different responses.
Okay, well, thank you for that, Sophie. I've got a passage from the very first page of the book, which kind of sets up a central inquiry that Nelson returns to over and over and over again throughout the rest of the text. So I'll just read that now. Before we met, I'd spent a lifetime devoted to Wittgenstein's idea that the inexpressible is contained inexpressibly in the expressed. This idea gets less airtime than his more reverential whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. But it is, I think, the deeper idea. Its paradox is quite literally why I write, or how I feel able to keep writing. For it doesn't feed or exalt any angst one may feel about the incapacity to express in words that which eludes them. It doesn't punish what can be said, nor does it ham it up by mimicking a constricted throat. Lo, what I would say were words good enough. Words are good enough. It's idle to fault a net for having holes, my encyclopedia notes. Before long, I learned that you had spent a lifetime equally devoted to the conviction that words are not good enough. Not only not good enough, but corrosive to all that is good, all that is real, all that is flow. We argued and argued on this account, full of fever, not malice. Once we name something, you said, we can never see it the same way again. All that is unnameable falls away, gets lost, is murdered. You call this the cookie-cutter function of our minds. You said that you knew this not from shunning language, but from immersion in it, on the screen, in conversation, on stage, on the page. I argued along the lines of Thomas Jefferson and the churches for plethora, for kaleidoscopic shifting, for excess. I insisted that words did more than nominate. For a time, I thought I'd won. I'll try and sort of summarise why I picked that passage in particular. So this paradox of the expressible and the inexpressible is something which runs through, like I said, the whole text, and I feel like Nelson's treatment of it is really interesting. Because it's kind of a hackneyed question for poetics, right, and for philosophy. She kind of has this... It kind of repeats like a feedback loop throughout the whole text, and she returns to it and returns to it and returns to it, and it becomes a kind of lens that she moves over.
As the philosopher who had multiple stillbirths,
who talked about
never being able to write about that experience because
words. That was Mary Oppen, I think.
Yes.
Yep, that's right. Totally. And she kind of returns to that question and gives a different answer every time, based on what kind of narrative fragment she's anchoring it to. She's either anchoring it to a narrative fragment in this kind of, like, in the context of her own life and experience, or she's anchoring it to a fragment of another author's texts with which she has great intimacy, you know. So she makes it very personal in that way, and continually kind of draws in this really huge, really diffuse philosophical question around language and the function of language and how we inhabit language, and kind of brings us into great intimacy with it. And I think I chose that passage in particular because this question of the inexpressible and the expressed and this kind of meebus flow between those two, and this question of language as a siphon for embodied experience or its failure thereof or whatever, is something which I feel is really deeply enmeshed in my own life,
yes,
like as a queer political subject.
And as someone who works with their body.
And as someone who works with their body and with physical vocabulary and also with language. So, and I think I read that passage at a time where I was going through a really specific and very kind of uncomfortable encounter with language, in the sense that I've always had a kind of relationship to language which, much like Nelson's, is very mercurial and very much about about excess, but excess as a kind of avoidance strategy in itself, or a kind of a way of obliterating hard boundaries of definition. And I was going through a process, or I have been going through a process for like the last 3 years or so, where I've had to kind of acquiesce to certain political terminologies or political languages, which I have historically found really difficult in terms of my own self. First of all, I've started explicitly and publicly saying that I'm not a woman, explicitly and publicly identifying myself as a transgender person and as a non-binary transgender person, and having to come into some kind of relationship with that language and everything that's contained, like the discourse that's... I was changing my name, and I was changing or publicly enforcing my chosen pronouns. So that was a really complex negotiation. It remains a really complex negotiation, and Nelson's book was a really valuable companion in that.
Oh, fantastic, thanks. Yeah. Hannah.
So I'm just I'm going to read a little passage where Maggie Nelson's talking about this friend of hers who said, don't produce and don't reproduce. And she's also talking about, in this kind of discussion, the theorist Lee Edelman, who wrote a book called No Future. And Edelman has this kind of polemic against the figure of the child in society. The child is this figure of this reproductive future that we're, you know, called to as a society. We're forced to embrace this child and believe in this promise of tomorrow. And it's a reproductive one that's very much about the family. So this is her response to that. I know that Edelman is talking about the child, not children per se, and that my artist friend is likely more concerned with jamming the capitalist status quo than with prohibiting the act of childbirth. And I too feel like jamming a stick in someone's eye every time I hear protecting the children as a rationale for all kinds of nefarious agendas, from arming kindergarten teachers to dropping a nuclear bomb on Iran to gutting all social safety nets to extracting and burning through what's left of the world's fossil fuel supply. But why bother fucking this child when we could be fucking the specific forces that mobilise and crouch behind its image? Reproductive futurism needs no more disciples. But basking in the punk allure left for us to do is sit back and watch while the gratuitously wealthy and greedy shred our economy and our climate and our planet, crowing all the while about how lucky the jealous roaches are to get the crumbs that fall from their banquet. Fuck them, I say. So, I mean, I guess the reason I wanted to read that is because it's exciting. It's exciting to me. And
she's a very exciting writer.
Yeah.
Very visceral.
And I think it's interesting because I quite love Lee Edelman. I use Lee Edelman a lot. And when you read his critique of the figure of the child, it's also really exciting and it's also really, you know, it's really true, I guess, to queer experience to say, you know, look at how everyone's enrolled in this this imaginary, this fantasy of having to reproduce and having to believe in tomorrow and having to, you know, locate all of these things in this actually very, it's symbolic, but it's also very literal figure of the child. And fuck that. And then Maggie Nelson kind of coming up against that as a critical thinker and wanting to have a child of her own, who is not the symbolic child, but
an actual child.
And yet her questioning her own, you know, place as a queer woman in that reproductive storyline, that fantasy. And I think what's so fantastic about this book is, for me at the beginning, she's really, this is the way I read it. I mean, she seems to me quite knotted in talking about normative life and whether she, you know, she's having this struggle, and it's all very much like drawing on theorists all the time. But as she progresses, I feel like she does that less, or it stands out less and it becomes less knotted and it untangles, and it's just about her experience and it becomes less like something that she has to explain, and it's just about her working through it. So that's why I really loved it.
Yeah, I want to actually come back to the way she uses theorists and has conversations with them in the book after soon. Quinn, what would you like to read?
So I'm going to read from page 52 and then a little bit of page 53. How to explain. Trans may work well enough as shorthand, but the quickly developing mainstream narrative it evokes, born in the wrong body, necessitating an orthopaedic pilgrimage between two fixed destinations, is useless for some, but partially or even profoundly may mean leaving one gender entirely behind, while for others, like Harry, isn't. I'm not on my way anywhere, Harry sometimes tells inquirers. How to explain in a culture frantic for resolution that sometimes the shit stays messy. And this is a quote from Paul Preciado, who wrote Testo Junkie. I do not want the female gender that has been assigned to me at birth. Neither do I want the male gender that transsexual medicine can furnish and that the state will award me if I behave in the right way. I don't want any of it. How to explain that for some, or for some at some times, this irresolution is okay, desirable even, e.g. gender hackers, whereas for others or for others at some times, it stays a source of conflict or grief. How does one get across the fact that the best way to find out how people feel about their gender or their sexuality or anything else really is to listen to what they tell you and to try to treat them accordingly without shellacking over their version of reality with yours? I kind of feel like that speaks for itself. Okay. I mean, I'm happy to talk to it a little bit in that I think we're finding ourselves... I've just been doing some archival research at the Wellcome Collection in Bloomsbury in London, in a trans archive that spans from the late 1800s up until the mid-90s. And fabulously came across something from 1976 that claimed 1976 was the year of trans visibility, which in the context of now is great. I love that, okay, because 2015 was named as the year of trans visibility by a bunch of kind of popular media sites and newspapers. And I think that's fascinating. It's 30 years later and we're still going, oh, my God, there are trans people and they are living lives and it's kind of complex and what are they doing? And they still want to know what's in our pants, which seems to be one of the main kind of public concerns. And then we're getting these really interesting kind of big media moments around, obviously, Caitlyn Jenner, Laverne Cox, Kate McGregor here. We're getting these big moments of kind of these big statements, this reification of I was born in the wrong body and I had these medico kind of legal interactions in the world that I live in and now I'm better and I fit and everything's cool now, guys. It's all good. And so just that articulation of sitting with difference and with complexity and with not there and not there either. What an intervention, I think, in this space that we're in right now.
One of the things I should have said when I was introducing the book was that there are two... The whole book is mercurial and is about change, but there are two major transitions in the book, and one is Maggie Nelson's transition or attempts to become pregnant, then having a pregnant body, then having a child, and her partner, Harry, becoming a trans person. And so that allows her, her personal situation allows her to explore a lot of complex things in a very kind of relaxed way or a very intimate way. That word's come up a couple of times. I had two questions. I think people could pick up either one of these. Two things that really interested me. One was... There's a sequence in the book where Maggie talks about Harry's discomfort about how she's writing him. And, in fact, I've read various interviews where he has said, I'm a private person. It's not just that I think she's getting it wrong. I'm a private... I don't really want to have to talk about this stuff at all. But... So I found that whole debate about what rights do other people have to tell stories about transitioning, the non-transitioning partner, what rights do they have? And I'd be interested in people's views on that. I also really enjoyed the writing about that sort of perverse maternal or what is perceived to be a perversity around motherhood, even if it's not experienced as perversity in the person who's a mother. Mm. So I don't know if anyone wants to leap in and comment on either of those.
I'm happy to start. I mean, I think the question about who can write what is a continuing and burning question, yeah. In autobiography and memoir in those fields. I think Nelson does a really good job of putting down the conversations that she's had with Harry, of saying that she that they've had this negotiation, this almost line-by-line negotiation about what can be included and what can't. And I think that that's a negotiation that any autobiographer or writer of memoir has to kind of make with the people that surround them, because it's not everyone else's fault that they're near a writer, right? And I know that Helen Garner talks about that quite a bit as well, about her sister. You know, it's just this, unfortunately, you've got me and I'm going to write about you now.
But one thing she says, which I would argue with, and I think I'd be brave enough to do it if she was sitting here, is that she says, but I'm hard on myself. The hook will give you permission to be revealing about other people. And I do think writers make that mistake. Yeah.
I think there are generous ways that we can write others, and I think there are gentle and holding ways that we can write others, no matter what the thing is that we're writing. Your question about can somebody else write someone else's transition, I think Nelson navigates that pretty well in that she basically avoids doing that, and she writes about her own emotional responses to Harry's transition. And that's all she... I mean, that's all we can do is write our position in that kind of genre, I think.
I read this interview where someone was asking Harry about how he felt about the vulnerability, you know, the intimacy that was revealed, whether it was Maggie Nelson's, you know, perspective or not. And he said he's such a private person, it's like an epileptic dating a strobe light artist.
Yeah, I think they were probably both pretty brave in that respect. And I feel like there's I mean, what comes through to me in the text at least is that there is a sort of... that this is a consensual exchange. And, sorry. I feel like it's a consensual exchange and that it's negotiated and that there's... that there's a very kind and spacious negotiation going on there. Like Quinn said, I feel like there is a way to do this, and that is a methodological question for anyone who's calling themselves a queer or feminist writer, you know. And I think she kind of embraces that question, and I think she embraces her own failure as well.
I thought she was quite hard on herself at points, in fact.
She is hard on herself at points.
One of the things I think about the experience of reading the book is that it's a very intimate book. But I suspect that she would feel that she's actually withheld quite a lot of herself. I know that, I mean, with a book I've written, which has absolutely nothing to do with this subject, Melbourne, people keep saying, oh, it's so personal, and my sense is that it's not a personal book at all. I use some personal experiences to organise narrative, but doesn't feel it's an intellectual activity. And to some extent, I think she does quite a good job of describing quite intimate issues, but while kind of holding herself back. And I think she does that in her other work as well. She's slightly coyer, possibly, when she's talking about perverse maternity. That's why I felt she used a lot more theorists than... the idea about how if you, for example, interested in S&M practices and discusses theorists or performance artists who's kind of negotiated that, and she doesn't particularly put herself on the line in that particular debate. I'm not saying she should have, but...
It's risky territory.
Yeah.
You know.
I think she makes some comment about she's not really up for...
Yeah.
Too much when she's just had a child, or make some kind of slightly off the cuff comment, but that's about
it. Yeah, I think she was quoting Catherine Opie, I think, at that point, where she was, there was some interview material of Catherine Opie after she'd had a child and talking about, you know, not sort of countering this cultural urge to desexualize the maternal body strip the maternal body of its kind of sexual agency and all this kind of stuff. But she was also talking about the problematics of that. What was it? It was like, what was it that Catherine Opie said? It was like, that's all true, and it's this part of me is not lost, basically, but it is also functionally quite difficult to start thinking about hurting someone when you're in a maternal mode. Like it's, and so she talks about this being a gear shift, but that gear shift doesn't obliterate the existing agency of that subject.
Yeah.
You know.
And she also talks, I think, interestingly, about boundaries. So she talks about the fact that people get, there's a confusion around the fact that breastfeeding can be experienced, can be an erotic experience. Mm. And she says, well, I'm always very clear that just because it's an erotic experience doesn't mean I have inappropriate feelings towards my child, yeah. So that we kind of, people get very messy around that.
I really appreciated her kind of delineation of that. I thought, yeah. It was really skillful. I remember that passage, but I think what she said was, it's an erotics without teleology, mm. Like it's not, and that that it's not going to be actualised in any way.
Yes.
You know.
It's just a feeling.
Yeah. So, I birthed two babies before, yes, I transitioned, and I got turned on breastfeeding both of them,
yeah.
And I was terrified at this feeling of, like, because we were lying down and it was nighttime and there's this little baby sucking and sucking, and I had this turned on sensation, and I got so frightened that I turned the light on and I sat myself up in bed and, like, propped a pillow under my arm and just did the good breastfeeding body thing that you get taught by the terrifying maternal child health nurses that visit your home and inspect everything you do, right? It's terrifying. It's like the state enters and then tells you how to be. And then I read Alison Bartlett, who's a Sydney academic, writing really beautiful stuff about feeling turned on and breastfeeding. And I had mail just going, thank you so much for telling me it was okay to feel turned on while I was breastfeeding my baby. And that was one of those real tips. I ended up writing a 10,000-word chapter in my first book on breastfeeding alone, because I had to hunt to find information about breastfeeding that wasn't a Vaseline-covered lens and nursing pads and clucking as a baby sucked gently. Meanwhile, my baby was eating my nipple and having blood with his milk, you know. So there's, you know, there's what we know, and when we go through it, and then it's what gets told, and which again comes back to Nelson's stuff about the sayable and the unsayable. What, you know, what is it even possible to say, yeah. in these spaces?
As someone who has had children and has trans or is transitioning, do you think that having implicit parallels between the two states is useful or meaningful, the way that Nelson does it, or is it...
Can you say a bit more about that, Sophie?
Well, just in the structure of the book, as she describes herself being on hormone treatment and then her body changing once she is pregnant, at the same time as Harry's body changing, there are quite a few descriptions of their two bodies in a state of change. Is that fair to draw out the relationship between them, or is your experience that they're totally different things and it's not really a... It's a certainly very poetic and interesting analogy to read, but is it... Do you think it's... Like, we can't just say that... Well, maybe we want to say Maggie Nelson gets everything right, but maybe she doesn't. I'm curious to know what you think about that.
Yeah, I don't think she gets everything right. So I don't know if I'm a bit unpopular in saying that, but I don't necessarily. I'm not in love with this book. I love the space that it's made for opening up to a general readership, work and life writing that engages with theory and with poetics and is talking the body. I love that. I think the fundamental difference between having a pregnant body and having a body that's transitioning is the pregnant body returns to a non-pregnant state. It's never the same body. And it's always has this kind of that invisible umbilical cord that people talk about that will never kind of disappear, but and is negotiating identity and the ways that it gets seen. So as a masculine presenting person who was breastfeeding, that was really challenging. But the level of negotiation that I do on sometimes a minute by minute basis in my world as a trans person is very, very different to and unless I'm with my queer and trans folk, violent, aggressive, or rude responses from the general public rather than loving, supportive, let me open that door for you, how many weeks are you?
Yes, well, motherhood is deified and being a trans person is not. So that's
well, that was kind of an abject process for cis people, yeah.
I might come back to you about what... some of the more critical things you wanted to say about the book, but one of the other things I did want to talk about was the way in which the book is written. And it's actually one of the things I really value about the book as a writer, as someone who's trying to write interesting nonfiction. I had learnt a lot from reading the book, the way that she negotiated complex thinkers, quoting other people and personal experience in a way that didn't feel overly academic. I did feminist theory in the 80s at a university, and I can't read my thesis anymore. I mean, I can't understand my thesis anymore because the language is so dense. But some of what I learnt came back to me when I was reading this book, and I was just so impressed by the way she managed to communicate those kind of very complex theories in a way that was really accessible. I wanted to know what other people thought about that, whether they agree with me about that. Hannah, you've been very polite and quiet.
I was concerned about this when I first read this book. And I asked a few people, and people seemed to say, I don't have any kind of background. I'm not an academic, and I really loved it. I'm a mother, and it spoke to me in this way. And I think that is the beauty of this book, is that there are so many different things in it. I mean, it came across in the passages that we read that speak to so many different kinds of people, that it's like an intimate story for all of us. So, I mean, that's how I...
Do you think she does justice to the theorists that she quotes? I ask as someone who's not totally sure, because I'm not on top of all the theorists that she's working with.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I didn't come across anything that I thought was a bit weird or misreading. And I loved how she talked about this this academic kind of fight that happened. I can't remember.
Oh, the Jane Gallup?
Yes, it was Jane Gallup.
That really struck me. That was really interesting.
So for anyone that hasn't read the book, Jane Gallup is giving this seminar, and Rebecca Krauss, is that the...
I can't actually remember.
Rosalind. Interlocker.
Because I was a Jane Rosalind. Gallup fan, was, yeah. So I was just... Yeah. Anyway, standing with Jane.
The person who's engaging with Jane Gallup afterwards, instead of providing a kind of generous discussion, launches this on saying that Jane Gallup's been too narcissistic, basically, and talking about motherhood. Anyway, I really appreciated that. You know, I come from a philosophy background, so I know what that environment is like.
But also she uses that, and this is something she comes back to a lot, is the idea of shaming. Yeah. And she just says the bottom line is, while she might have issue with some of the way that latter Jane Gallup presented things, you shouldn't shame people. That's something, a kind of ethical position she kind of returns to over and over again, I think, in the book.
It was funny because this question of that I had, which was, you know, how accessible is this book? I was like, if a man had written this book, would I really ask that question? Like, we hold, you know, the great male writers of history, dense writers, but we never question, oh, is Zizek accessible? Like, no, everyone's like, oh, you've just got to work a bit harder.
You may not in academia, but in the commercial sphere, you might. I mean, what's interesting about this book is that it's done so well commercially.
I think sometimes maybe the publishing industry doesn't think about how intelligent general readers are. Yep. And I think that's sad. But I think also there are many examples of life writing or nonfiction woven through with theory. When thinking of Alison Bechdel's Fun Home and Are You My Mother Right Now, and I don't think people are asking whether that's accessible or whether the theory is understandable. I don't know if it's because there's pictures in there, but this is an incredible example of negotiating life writing, nonfiction and theory. Kathy Acker in the 90s was doing a very, very beautiful job of integrating theory and fiction and autofiction and a whole bunch of stuff. And I know Onyx's bio, especially, it's the excitement about, oh my God, here's some writing that has some theory in it and we can read it. And it's like, but where's the acknowledgement of decades of fictocritical writing in Australia, in France, in the UK, in Canada, and so I'm wondering about, is it just that North America's just discovered that they can do this, and that's why it's so exciting? Like, what's going on there that this is incredibly exciting? We're really lucky in Australia to have writers like Marion May Campbell, Anna Gibbs, Kathleen Mary Fallon, Roz Prosser. I mean, I could just go on and on about the incredible kind of heritage and of feminist and queer ficto-critical writing that we have in this country alone. So.
I've wondered the same thing. I'm like, why this book?
Mm.
I mean, in one respect, I also know why this book as well, because the writing in this book, I think, is extraordinary.
Mm.
Like, I think it's extraordinary. A lot of people have really responded to it, and I think it is a really, like, exceptional example of really good ficto-critical writing. So on the one hand, I'm like, well, fair enough, this book. But the erasure of the fact that this book sits within a much broader literary discourse of ficto-critical writing and critical discourse of ficto-critical writing and practice is really strange.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I think Nelson would say that too. Like, I think she's probably fully, her work sits.
Yeah.
And so, but it's this interesting, it's an interesting moment.
She said she's really surprised by how this book has taken off.
It's also like her ninth book or something, right? So I imagine if I was her, I'd be like, why this book? Why not any of the other nine books that I've written about all sorts of stuff, you know?
When I've read The Red Parts, I thought that was an extraordinary.
Yeah, I've been carrying Bluettes around with me. It's very beautiful.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like one of her, I read a review that quoted one of her friends saying, you know, I think Maggie Nelson just says what we need to hear at the time that we need to hear it. So I feel like maybe that's what's going on, is that it's not that this history hasn't existed and that it wouldn't have also explicitly fed into her writing this, but more that people are at a space where they can hear it differently now. I mean, I see that with my students. Not sure if it's the same for you, Quinn, but there's things that I was teaching 5 years ago that are kind of, students are way all over that now, or they're at a totally different space and they need to hear something different. And I see people like my brother who's 15, and he talks to me about heteronormativity, and I'm like, whoa, okay, by the time you get into first year, what am I going to teach?
My six-year-old asked my eight-year-old what gender he was the other day. My eight-year-old said, my gender is helicopter.
Fair call.
Such good material. They're just going to go on being good material. I love it.
In fact, you in a way touched on this, Quinn, when you talked about 1976 being the year of the visibility or the visible transsexual, and again in 2015, it is slightly exhausting how the same conversations happen over and over again. And so part of the reason I enjoyed this book was because it did pick up on a lot of the theory and talking that was happening in the 80s.
Mm.
And while it can be slightly galling that some people aren't aware that the conversation has been going on for a long time, it's still very nice that the conversation has been revitalised in some way.
Absolutely.
Now, we've got 15 minutes left, so I did want to ask, throw out a question. Perhaps I'm going to ask one more question of the panel whilst to give people a chance to think about it. Onyx, I know that that the quote I read where I talked about the phrase same-sex marriage, that you had something to kind of say.
Misread the context of what you were saying.
But nonetheless, I still think same-sex marriage is an interesting phrase, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's certainly problematic in the you know, context of my life, because the question of sex is very problematic and highly open to debate in my life and in a lot of people's lives.
Well, I think it is in more lives than I mean, this Bloomsbury being an example. I mean, there were kind of complicated arrangements being made with marriage that weren't labelled in the same way, but it was people resisting traditional structures. And indeed, Victorian marriages had all kinds of companionate kind of arrangements and whatever. So the phrase same-sex marriage is assuming a very particular definition of marriage, which probably isn't even a very real experience, most people's experience of what marriage might be.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly assuming
whatever their gender.
The primacy of a specific definition of marriage, and also the primacy of a specific definition of sex, or the usefulness of sex even as a term for defining a person or someone's life or existence, much less their relationship. I am married. My wife and I, we call each other wifey.
Yes,
we have a kind of semi-subversive kind of embrace of that term. We walk through the world readable as a same-sex couple, and people very aggressively lady us all the time. We're ladies and girls, and it's like, oh, look at you girls, like, good on you. And it's patronising. I'm out of birth non-binary, my partner is trans feminine. So, in those terms, it's not a same-sex union, but our sameness is defined through... our sameness is defined through something very, very different, like a completely different range of questions,
Yeah, I got married at Brooklyn City Hall about 3 years ago now, and all the staff had sort of positive affirmation training for gay people. So Virginia and I were getting treated much better than the heterosexuals, because it was like, great to see you, this is really exciting. Yeah. It was a very kind of... interesting time to be in America, because you're both people. I'm very grateful that they allowed us to be married, but it was also you're one of us now.
Yeah,
and that's
it's
kind of
freaky.
A slightly Stepford Wives kind of vibe. Now, do we have? Yes, I won't point if you could.
Hi, thanks for your comments. It's been really interesting. I haven't read the book. But I wanted to ask you about the quality of the prose. I'm a historian, and I write about the history of sexuality. And one of my pet hates in my discipline is people who write about sex and make it really unerotic. Like, how do you make sex boring? I don't know, but people do it all the time. And I wondered how you thought Nelson did with writing about changing bodies and the politics of changing bodies. Does the prose reflect the subject of what she's talking about?
I think it's a very beautiful book. Mm. I mean, and she is a poet, and one of the reasons I liked it so much was because I found it erotic at times, very moving, and she's a beautiful stylist. But that's my view. I'm not sure if what the rest of the panel thinks.
It wasn't quite poetic enough for me. But I'm a bit of a fiend like that. There are some very beautiful lines. I recall a beautiful line about mountains and blood, and there's some really lovely moments. And there's one... So one of the things I was most disappointed about was where she said, I don't just want to talk about us fucking, I want to write it. Yeah. And then she didn't write it. And I was like, no! But you said you were going to do that, and now you haven't. What happened? But she does write one very hot sex scene that goes for maybe two-thirds of a page. But I felt, that coming back to that thing about what's left out. So I was like, I'm a bit of an over-discloser in case you haven't noticed. But I kind of just was like, I want more.
Bluettes. I seem to remember there's more explicitly sexual material in Bluettes and in the red parts, because it's about a sort of sexual crime and how that then impacts on her own sexuality. So she can do it. I actually felt she withheld quite a lot in this book, more than people seem to think she did.
I think from the discussions that we glean with Harry, that's a protective mechanism for her partner.
Which is fair enough.
Yeah.
And I think it's also... I didn't feel like it was necessarily with Heck. There might not be so many directly descriptive... sexually descriptive passages, and I think you're absolutely right, Quinn, in the reason why she's chosen not to do that. But I feel like my feeling about her prose is that it's all really libidinal, for me it was a really sexy book, like a deeply erotic book, but it was not sexually explicit all the time, even though she does talk about ass fucking on like the third page or something,
But not enough.
Not enough. There's not enough butt sex. It's true. There's never enough butt sex.
Any other questions?
Hello. I'm interested in the idea of rebellion and what is and isn't rebellion. So Nelson does talk about that in the book, if you remember. So I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on that. You know, what's mainstream and then what's mainstream rebellion and what's,
Do you mean in terms of writing or in terms of lived experience?
Just in terms of that idea and what your thoughts are on that idea.
Do you mean in terms of the way she talks about the normative versus the radical or...?
Yes.
Yeah.
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 Hannah, you were going to say something.
I think for me it was a great illustration of how we can get caught up in trying to do so much rebellion through our individual formations, I guess. And I see it around me all the time and in my own life, you know, where you're you feel the weight of expectations and structures that do horrible violence to you and to the people around you, and particularly if you're queer identifying, and you know, you see people struggling with that and trying to work it out intellectually and trying to be ethical, I suppose. And that's why I read that passage out about, you know, fuck them, because we can, I think, lose sight of how our that inner turmoil as we're trying to struggle with the structures that are, you know, violently shaping us. We're trying to just individually resolve it in this kind of psychological way rather than turning outward with our rebellion in an act of solidarity. So I got that from her, not necessarily because she didn't really riff on it past that passage, but because I think there's a moment at the moment in the world for that sentiment, and I hope...
She was resisting, to some extent, being seen as rebellious, like that she was uncomfortable with that the phrase being radical or rebellious was almost something that she didn't want to take on because it suggested that they were outside or not normal, or that she kind of... But that was just a feeling I had.
I feel like she was trying to kind of trouble sort of a fetishistic idea of radicalism.
That's what I mean.
And trying to find a deeper way of engaging with this concept, or how to kind of forge a trajectory into that without relying on kind of political tropes or fetishes. Yeah.
Yeah.
She had that really interesting moment where she discussed her old lecturer who had this group. I think they were a gender studies lecturer, and this group formed that was like, your queer politics is not political enough, so we're going to form this other identity politics queer group and we're not going to come to your lectures. And I just thought it was... I mean, it's my fear as a gender studies lecturer. But it was a beautiful illustration of the tension, I guess, and the desire for the political that everyone has, but what that means and how to negotiate that. And she doesn't resolve that.
Yeah. I think she also talks a lot about, you know, this is a book about happiness as well.
Yeah.
And how, you know, to be a queer subject, you're kind of locked in this position of suffering continually.
Yes.
And of kind of pugilism against a paradigm, and that has a potential to rob you of happiness, like obviously it does, because that reality sucks, but if she also doesn't talk about those two things as being mutually exclusive, or she kind of proposes this idea that, you know, you don't actually have to sacrifice your happiness in order to resist or to hold a position of political resistance in the world, you know?
I thought she had a complicated relationship to that whole idea. Not wanting to be seen as exotic, not wanting to make rebellion to be seen as, I don't know, something acute or kind of...
I think she was also...
Wacky people do.
Yeah, talking a bit about the fear of being seen as homonormative from with her own in her own community as well. And I think that is...
And the struggle is real.
That happens. That happens. You know, I think sometimes in queer spaces, it's desperately sad.
Yeah.
And it needs to change. Yeah. It needs not useful. It's not rebellious and it's not radical. And so she's kind of negotiating that bit where she goes, how can we possibly get married? We're getting married, you know. How can we possibly have a baby? We're having a baby. Like that, that. And the happiness thing, like do we have to have Edelman's No Future, or can we have the baby? But then the baby's born and now there's climate change and sorry, you're fucked. Like, you know, so on it goes. And I think she sort of really shows that. Yeah.
Any other questions? Yeah.
Question. So two, actually. So the first is I completely agree that I don't think as a work of ficto-criticism it's that great in the canon of such, but I think it's a handout to straight men and asking them to understand the transgender identity, and I'm saying that as a straight man. And the second question I had was for you, I think, Hannah. There's this part where she says, and leading on to your point about Lee Edelman's bit, where she says, when all the mythologies have been set aside, we can see that children or no children, the joke of evolution is that it is an ideology, a teleology, without a point, that we, like all animals, are a project that issues in nothing. Do you think she ever resolves Lee Edelman's point throughout the book? I don't think she does. But
I think the fact that she doesn't provide a resolution to so many of the conundrums that she presents is part of the point. Mm. It's about the messiness of life and trying to negotiate it, but not necessarily working it out. I mean, isn't that what we're all doing? I don't think it's written for straight men. But
yeah, why do you... I mean, other than you being a straight man who got something out of the book, why do you see it like that?
As a straight guy that's interested in gender and transgender issues, I think it was incredibly readable. And I think actually... It was actually one of the points that one of the panellists said about unknotting inexpressibility and making it about very simple things, like when her mother dies. That's something that's completely relatable. Was her mother-in-law, completely relatable to the general populace. So I think it's actually incredibly readable for...
Do you think that's a bad thing?
No, I think it's a great thing.
Right, okay.
I think it's a great thing. I think it finally there's a work out there in ficto criticism that's approachable for the straight population. I don't know what you guys think about that.
Phew.
Okay, any more? We've got time for one more question.
Thank you for such an interesting discussion. So something I really loved in the book was where Nelson speaks about... She's speaking, I think, about the legalisation of same-sex marriage, and she sort of ponders this question of whether kind of claims that people make are routinised to the point of legalisation or similar. Maybe they lose their teeth. And I wonder... I've been wondering if the book is an example of that same thing, and if maybe the fact that it's reached such a warm reception from such a wide audience... is a consequence of her having made trade-offs in some way in the writing of it. And I wondered if any of you had sort of thought about that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I actually have a comment about the first part of your question, not the second, and that is that when there's a lot of debate about marriage and people's right to get married and it not being radical... I don't know that you necessarily sign on to be radical if you're queer. You know, I'm not a particularly radical person, but people assign you a particular role. So I don't have that particular problem with marriage. But that doesn't answer your question about Nelson's book, and that's a very interesting question. I don't know if I've got the flashing red. We'll wind up in a sec. Does anyone have a view about whether they think it's sort of too... Is that one of your reservations about the book, Quinn, that it's sort of... doesn't have so many teeth, to quote...
I'm thinking of vagina dentata.
Yes, so was I.
Look, as someone who's... I wrote an autobiography of my body. It was very much to do with my own birthing body, but a search for my mother, who lives with a mental illness, who has bipolar, who gave me permission to write the book, but I knew she would never read it. So talking about those approaches of kindness and holding when we write quite intense and revealing autobiography is that in that process of writing, you do have to take some teeth out sometimes, and editors do that as well. I mean, I would have been fascinated to sit around and to see versions of this book come out, and I think sometimes we do have to exchange teeth for the protection of our loved ones and for the people that are surround us. And I mean, maybe ending here on queer kinship and the value of the people that we have and of our chosen kin, and that we have to love them, and saying too much is not sometimes love.
That's a beautiful note to end on. So thank you, Quinn, Hannah, Onyx, and thank you all for coming. And thank you, Maggie.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.